So I have a question.
Okay.
I have more than one, but in Genesis 6:9, Noah is perfect in his generation. What does that mean?
The term that's used there is not a term of absolute perfection. He was upstanding, is the concept. We have descriptions of various people in various places in the Bible where it mentions similar statements, Joseph and Mary, for example. But it's not a term of absolute moral perfection.
Right. And then the second part of that is that God was sorry he made man. Is that the same as God is grieving because man made bad decisions?
Yeah, what we see in the book of Genesis with each of the Toledot, actually look at the first part of verse 9. Many of our translations say something like what the New King James has here. This is the genealogy of Noah. It would be better rendered, these are the generations of Noah. And so if you hear me use the word toledot, that's a Hebrew word that appears here. And so the book of Genesis is arranged around toledot. Now, what it would be like is if you show up at your high school reunion and someone says, look at what became of so-and-so. No one would have ever imagined that this is what he would have become. That's what's going on here. Each time you have this statement, it's saying, look at what now develops out of this person and the generations that succeed him. The book of Genesis has a series of those that are divisions within the book showing these sections, and so each toledot has a very interesting feature. God always starts out with something good, and by the time you get to the end of the toledot, man has succeeded in messing it up pretty badly. Start a new toledot, and God brings about resolution. You get to the end of that toledot, and it's pretty bad. And we have a continual cycle here in the book of Genesis that is demonstrating that although God brings about good, man is capable of messing it up, but God is still in the business of restoration. And so the book of Genesis is demonstrating to the children of Israel that their God, a God with whom they have not stayed in touch with at all. Israel was continually running away from him. Whether we're looking in Genesis, whether we're looking in Exodus, no matter where we look, Israel was always running away from God. But God remains faithful to his promise. And the book of Genesis is demonstrating to the Israelites that it was worthwhile for them to believe in the Lord and to get serious about what he was saying. And that's part of the demonstration within the argument. So every time when you're reading in Genesis, you see a statement like that which appears in 6:9, this is the genealogy of, or this is the history of, or if you're reading in the Old King James, these are the generations of. That's a fairly literal rendering. That's what's going on.
And how come in verse 17, Ishmael gets to be a great nation like Abraham?
Well, he became a great nation, but it was not as great a nation. God had promised to Abraham, actually when he was still named Abram, that among other things he would become that many nations would come from him. There would be kings that would come from him. This is part of the fulfillment of that. And we also see when Rebecca was pregnant with twins. Interesting statement. And why don't we go here? This will be in your next week's reading, but let's look at Genesis 25. You may remember that the twins in her womb were struggling together. Look at verse 22 of chapter 25. But the children, this would be Jacob and Esau, before they're born, struggled together within her, and she said, "If all is well, why am I like this?" So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb. Two people shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other. The older shall serve the younger." Now let's go to Romans chapter 9. Hold your place in Genesis 25. Let's see. About 2000. Abraham was born in 2166 BC, and the book of Romans was written in 56 AD. Okay. Romans chapter 9, and we'll start at verse 10. Not only this, when Rebekah had also had conceived by one man, even our father Isaac, for the children not yet being born, nor having done any good or evil, that the purpose of God stands according to election might stand, not of works but of him who calls, it was said to her, "The older shall serve the younger. As it is written, Jacob have I loved, but Esau have I hated." Now you have undoubtedly heard sermons by Calvinists on this passage. And they say, you know, God chooses who's going to go to heaven and who is not going to go to heaven. And he determines who's going to believe in him, in Jesus Christ, and who isn't. And no one who is not elect will be able to believe. Ever hear any heresy like that? Mm-hmm. I've heard it. I want you to notice something. And this is something really important that people tend not to notice when they look at this passage. Look back at Genesis. What did he say in verse 23? Not two babies are in your womb, two nations are in your womb. Two people shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. What it is coming down to here, Jacob was the progenitor, the head, the first person of the nation Israel. Remember, Jacob's name will be changed to Israel. Esau was the head of a different nation. How many messianic lines are there?
One.
Is there a line that comes through the nation Edom? No. The choice here is the choice of who was going to carry the line that would culminate in Jesus Christ. Who was going to be the chosen nation? It was not an issue of who's going to heaven and who's going to hell. I would argue that both Jacob and Esau were believers. Book of Hebrews makes an argument in chapter 12 that makes absolutely no sense if Esau were an unbeliever. But now you see that last statement that we read in verse 13 of Romans 9. As it is written, Jacob have I loved, but Esau I have hated. Where does it say that that comes from? It does.
Genesis 25, 23?
No, no.
Malachi.
It is in Malachi. So Matthew is the first book of the New Testament. Malachi is the book immediately in front of it. The burden, the oracle, of the word of the Lord to Israel by Malachi. Verse 2. I have loved you, says the Lord, yet you say, in what way have you loved us? Notice it's plural. Was not Esau Jacob's brother, says the Lord. Yet Esau I have loved, Jacob I have loved, but Esau I have hated, and laid waste his mountains and his heritage for the jackals of the wilderness. Even though Edom, now who do you think Edom would be? Esau's descendants, the nation of Edom. Even though Edom has said, we have been impoverished, but we will return and build the desolate places. In the book of Malachi, what the Lord communicates to Israel is, I have loved Israel so much that when Edom measures how much I love them, they'll say it's as if you hated us, even though God blessed them. So it's related to the question that you asked, Julie. God is able to, he is so big that he can bless ones that are not going to receive the big blessing. He's not so small that he has to say, well, I'm going to bless Abraham and I'm going to bless Isaac. That means there's no room to do anything for Edom. And so when it mentions Jacob's name, it's Jacob standing for Israel. When he mentions Esau, it's Esau standing for his nation, Edom. God chose the nation of Israel to be his chosen people. That doesn't mean he hated everyone else in the world. Because what did he say in Genesis 12:3? In you shall all families of the earth be blessed. Israel was supposed to be a channel of blessing through whom God would be able to bless the whole earth. And that is indeed true, because guess what? Jesus Christ came through Israel. He was part of the line of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, David, and so forth. There's one messianic line, and God made a choice, since he said to Abraham that in you shall all families of the earth be blessed, in your lineage, he had to make a choice. Was it going to be through Isaac and his lineage, or was it going to be through Ishmael, and was it going to be through Jacob, or was it going to be through Esau? And God is so big that he can give lesser blessing. He doesn't have to say, oh, I'm blessing this person, so I can't bless that person.
Don't you go through Romans 12, where you said that it shows, demonstrates that he's not a believer?
Oh, Hebrews.
Oh, Hebrews.
Hebrews chapter 12. First of all, I would say that there is no statement, there is not a single statement that we could interpret. If we interpret properly, there's not a single statement in the Old Testament that would give any indication that Ishmael or Esau were unbelievers. But now let's look at Hebrews chapter 12. And the author of Hebrews has a series of warning passages, or as I like to call them, consequence passages. And so in Hebrews 12, he is writing to believers, and he says, let's start at verse 12. Therefore, strengthen the hands which hang down. In other words, believers are supposed to have a ministry with other believers. You see someone else suffering, you see someone else wandering away from the Lord, and in the book of Hebrews, people were wandering away from the Lord. So he's saying, strengthen your brothers who are getting discouraged, and so on and so forth. So strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees. Make straight paths for your feet so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather healed. Pursue peace with all, and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. Looking carefully, lest anyone fall short of the grace of God. He's saying, watch your fellow believers. Make sure that they aren't wandering away from the Lord. Lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble, and by this many become defiled. Now, does it sound like anything so far has been addressed to an unbeliever? Everything's addressed to believers. Lest, in order that this would not happen, that's what lest is, negative purpose. Lest there be any fornicator or profane person like Esau, who for one morsel of food sold his birthright. Now, the birthright was a reward. He's saying, don't throw away your reward like Esau did. Esau had a reward that was his by right of birth. These people, as has been discussed within Hebrews, are thus far rewardable, and he's saying, don't throw that away. Don't be like Esau, who threw his reward away. The argument doesn't make sense if Esau were an unbeliever. But what has happened is when people look at Romans chapter 9, they think it's a heaven-hell issue, whereas it's a choice of nations. We have other choices that happen in chapter 9 between Pharaoh and Israel. Is Pharaoh going to be able to stand in the way of God blessing Israel? No. God makes a choice between Israel and Egypt. God makes a choice between Israel and Edom. God's going to do what he promised Abraham.
So where does faith come in, or salvation come in, with, in relationship to people like Esau and Ishmael? And, I mean, because it was pre-cross. So how,
sure.
What is their salvation based on?
John, maybe this would be a good place for 3:15, 3:20, and 4:1. With
we'll get there. We'll get to 15:6 first. Okay, let's go to Genesis 15:6. This was part of your reading. This is a passage that is cited a number of times in the New Testament. Now, that would be a preferable translation to the end that most of our translations have. Genesis 15:6. This is a meanwhile back at the ranch. Now, he believed in the Lord, and he accounted it to him for righteousness. The book of Galatians makes a comment saying that Genesis 12:3, in you shall all families of the earth be blessed, was the gospel preached beforehand to Abraham. And he believed God's promise. Now God promised that he would own the land with its full boundaries, which is bigger than Israel has ever had, that he would own that forever. Now, one of the implications of owning it forever is you have to live forever to own something forever. And furthermore, God told on about three or four occasions, he said, to you and to your seed, I give this land forever. Hebrews chapter 11 says twice, all these died in faith without having received the promise. Without the resurrection and without everlasting life, God would prove to be a liar. He made promises, and the Bible tells us he did not fulfill it in the lifetime of Abraham, the lifetime of Isaac, the lifetime of Jacob, and yet he promised to each one of them, to you and to your seed I give this land forever. Now it is fascinating to look at how Paul reasoned, and we'll only look at one of the times he made this argument. He made it on more than one occasion, but let's go to Acts 26. In Acts 26, I believe that Paul makes it very clear that belief in the promise of everlasting life, and some, and a corollary of that, resurrection, is the heart of the message in the Old Testament. It's something that we don't see a lot of space devoted to, because the Old Testament books were not written from an evangelistic standpoint. I believe it's something that would have been communicated. It was designed to be communicated, but it would have been communicated orally rather than finding as much discussion of it as we see in the New Testament. This is when Paul is in prison, and he has not yet gone to Rome. He's in Caesarea, which is on the coast. Those of us who went to Israel, we were at Caesarea. We were where Paul was in prison. So here we have in 26:1, then Agrippa, king, who's in charge of these proceedings, said to Paul, "You are permitted to speak for yourself." So Paul stretched out his hand and answered for himself, "I think myself happy, King Agrippa, because today I shall answer for myself before you concerning all the things of which I am accused by the Jews, especially because you are expert in all customs and questions which have to do with the Jews. Therefore, I beg you to hear me patiently. My manner of life from my youth, which was spent from the beginning among my own nation at Jerusalem, all the Jews know. They knew me from the first, if they were willing to testify, that according to the strictest sect of our religion, I lived a Pharisee." And here's the punchline, getting set up. "And now I stand and am judged for the hope of the promise made by God to our fathers." Now, what was that promise? Land, seed, and blessing, and they would live in it forever. Now, you can't live in it forever if you've died without being resurrected, and you also need everlasting life. Resurrection and everlasting life are the heart of the Abrahamic promise. He says, that is Israel's hope. And he says, I am on trial for the hope of Israel. I'm standing up for what all Israel hopes for. And you might replace the word hope with expects. It's expectation. It's not just, I hope so. It's, they're certain. They know. God has promised. But then he says, to this promise are 12 tribes, the 12 tribes of Israel, hope to attain. Now here the hope is they want to. They want to attain to it. They don't know so. They know so that God is going to fulfill the promise, but they don't know so that they're going to get it. And so they are striving earnestly day and night. They're working. They're working to try to impress God. "For this hope's sake, King Agrippa, I am accused by the Jews." Now here is the punchline. "Why should it be thought incredible by you that God raises the dead?" How is it that Abraham is going to enjoy the promise God made to him? He died without having received the promise. He has to be resurrected, and he has to possess everlasting life to be able to enjoy the land forever. Resurrection is necessary for God to keep his promise. And so Paul says, all Israel is hoping to get what God promised. And yet, you're telling me that God doesn't resurrect the dead? He's saying, wait a moment. If we're going to have an argument, we ought to have an argument over whether God did raise Jesus, not whether God raises the dead. People were saying God doesn't raise the dead, so therefore he didn't raise Jesus. They say, come on, think logically with me. If you're going to get what God promised Abraham, it requires resurrection and everlasting life. It is entailed in the promise. Belief in God's promise of everlasting life is the core of the message, whether we're talking Old Testament or New Testament. What has happened is we tend to think, okay, God promised land, and then we say, so what does that have to do with salvation? But what we need to do is we need to realize the promise, participation in the promise of being resurrected to life happens for those who believe God for his promise. Now, what Steve was wanting me to point to is something I wanted to get to, and that is in Genesis, we can see evidence of what Adam and Eve both believed. Now, lots of people have recognized what Adam believed, but very few people have, what Eve believed, but very few people have figured out what it is that Adam believed. So let's go back to Genesis. And of course, this was part of the text that you read for... Now, when we look at Genesis chapter 3, after they ate of the fruit, and by the way, we don't have any idea what kind of fruit it was. Rabbis like to say it was figs. We won't get into that argument. We'll,
it was what?
Figs. And the reason that they said so was because they had to be pretty close to a fig tree at the time they realized they didn't have any clothes on, since they reached for fig leaves. So, look at what it says in Genesis 3:15, and this is addressed to the serpent who was indwelt by Satan. I will put enmity, I will make you enemies, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He, the seed of woman, Jesus Christ, will bruise your head. He will crush you. He'll deal with you permanently, and you shall bruise his heel. The cross could not, the death could not hold Jesus. He was not subject to death in the way that sinful humanity is. He's going to give Satan a mortal blow, but Satan in turn only bruises his heel, as is spoken. Now we can see evidence that Eve understood that God was indicating that seed of woman was going to be the one who was going to deal with the serpent. Look at chapter 4, verse 1. I will have to make a correction in the translation because the translators got two words mixed up. They got et mixed up with et. There are two words et, and we can tell when we look at these as they go through their forms that they are two distinct words. One word tells us the idea of with. I have my computer. I can even quote, I'll do it later, I won't do it now. But Brown Driver Briggs ends up saying that this use of et in this passage is different than any other passage that means with, and that's assuming that it means with. all the translators assume that it means with. But there's another word, et. And that word, et, tells us that the word that follows is either a direct object or is equal to the direct object. So in this sentence, it's going to be equal to the direct object. So I'll just retranslate it, and it'll make it a little easier. But let me translate it as it is here in my New King James. It is translated here, "And Adam knew Eve his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, and said, I have acquired a man," and you've got a word after that. My translation says from. Some of yours probably say with the help of. What other renderings do we have? Okay, from or with the help of. Now they're understanding it as a word that means with. However, with has a lot of different meanings. I'll make a sentence that I've made here before that is used, it will use the word with three times, and each of those three will have a completely different meaning. I walk with a limp, with a friend, with a cane. With a limp is mannerism. With a cane would be means. In other words, if a person really needs a cane, like I did when I was in Israel, not walking very far without it. Walking with a limp is mannerism. A person can have a limp and can still walk. But if their leg won't function right, they need something to help it. So, completely different idea between those two. And with a friend is accompaniment. Those are three completely different uses of the word with. And if et means with, whenever we have an et that means with, it means accompaniment. Now, as she's saying here, I have acquired a man and I was right next to the Lord. He was with me. That doesn't make a lot of sense. They're wanting to take it like with a cane, that the Lord enabled it. But the word et that means with does not mean enablement. It's not that kind of a with. On the other hand, if we take it as relating to the direct object, I have acquired a man. Man is the direct object. And this word is equal to that man. I have acquired a man. Well, what man? The Lord. Wait a moment. God is going to send seed of woman. She has just said, my firstborn is our deliverer. He's seed of woman. He's the Lord that's come here to earth. She says, God's going to send a deliverer. He's going to be born of a woman. I'm a woman. He's born of me. This is the deliverer. Now, one can't blame her for having high hopes for her firstborn. But notice, it tells us she believed what she understood the Lord to say. Now, the Lord didn't say what person was going to be that seed of woman. He didn't explain that was going to be a long time later that the deliverer was going to come. She said, we just had a problem. The Lord just brought a solution. Moses has told us about her content of faith. Now, what about Adam? What about his content of faith? Well, remember, God had explained that seed of woman was going to destroy the serpent, but then look at what is said in 3:16. To the woman, he said, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In pain you shall bring forth children. Now look at what Adam did in verse 20. And Adam called his wife Hava, or as it's rendered here, Eve. Why? Because she was the mother of all living. But she didn't have any babies yet. But he believed God's promise. So in both cases, both with Adam and with Eve, Moses gives us some indication of what they believed. When we read the Old Testament, we have to look for indications of the content that is believed by the people there. And that's something that's very easily passed over and is often passed over.
So in like Esau and Ishmael's case, what would have been the promise of everlasting life that was communicated to them?
Oh, I believe so. That God had made it clear that he was going to fulfill the promise to the chosen lineage, but all families of the earth were able to enjoy blessings out of that. In order to enjoy those blessings, one has to live eternally and has to have be resurrected. And so it's always inherent in the promise.
Thank you. That was very good.
One more question.
Okay.
Sorry. So the lineage in Matthew goes back to just Isaac. And is Shem, the lineage of Shem, Noah, Shem, once the flood came, then is it Shem? And through his lineage
right.
comes Jesus, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
And it gets narrowed down to Abraham,
uh-huh.
then to Isaac, then to Jacob, then to Judah.
Okay.
But as we pass Jacob, we now have 12 tribes in Israel, so it wasn't Judah was going to be the lineage and everyone else was a foreigner. They were all The 12 tribes were still part of one nation. Then it gets narrowed down later to David and so forth.
Okay.
So the Old Testament keeps narrowing that lineage, and what's God doing as he does that? He's choosing that as opposed to other lineages.
Uh-huh.
And so throughout the Old Testament, we are looking at the lineage that culminates in the Messiah. And the problem that happens when people get to the New Testament is they see choosing and they see people's names and they don't recognize that when God spoke about Jacob and Esau being in Rebekah's womb, God said, two nations are in your womb. The nation of the older shall serve the nation of the younger. And the focus of the choice was upon the lineage, the national lineage, rather than upon everlasting life or going to the lake of fire. So it's a lot of areas here where people get very confused. Okay.
John, I have 6, 2, and 3 are a little confusing to me. The sons of God taking women, daughters of men as wives.
And oh,
then,
sure.
And then, first of all, do you have any insight on that? And then secondly, verse 3 says God is going to limit...
Yes, it's there.
Okay. He's going to limit man's days to 120 years, and yet in verse 7, they're living centuries.
Yeah, there are a couple of interesting things here. First of all, you probably are all familiar that the normal word for God, Elohim, is a plural, right? It's a plural form. So, okay, I'll get to answering this, but we have to talk about the plural on Elohim. Let's turn to Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. When you see the word God, it is in the Old Testament, not New Testament, but Old Testament, is normally the word Elohim. Now, if it were Elo, that would be a singular form, or if it were El, both of those would be singular forms. But Im is a plural ending. Now, it's an interesting thing that happens in Hebrew, that although we would understand, and the Jews understood, that there is one God, that one God has a plurality about him. That is hinted at in Genesis 1:26. Notice it says, "Then God said." Now let's look at what God said. "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness." Okay, notice the plurality is being expressed. But I am going to retranslate that initial statement, "Then God said." I'm not going to do it because there's anything wrong with its meaning. I am going to retranslate it in order to make it clear exactly how the Hebrew is constructed. I'm going to do it by way of a verb tense in English that is more highly inflected. You don't have to know what that means. If I use the word "has," are we expecting the subject to be singular or plural?
Singular.
But if I use the word "have," in most cases, it is going to be a plural. The difference between "has" and "have" is an inflectional difference. So I said I'm going to use a tense that has inflection. So instead of saying "said," I'm going to say "God has said." But that word that's there, "God," is a plural form. So I'm going to do something that's going to seem really weird. "God's has said." It does not say "God's have said." It said "God's has said." They knew that they had a plural form. Although it was a plural form, they put it with a singular verb. Because there is one God, but the one God exists in a Trinity with three persons. And the Old Testament was hinting at that. And, you know, you really get a picture of it when you translate something, "God's has said." That doesn't sound like good grammar. We would expect it to be either "God has said," or we would expect it to be "God's have said." But the way the Hebrew reads is "God's has said." The fact that it uses a verb that would be like "has said" is a recognition there's one God. But even though there's one God, there is a sense of a plurality, because that one God exists in a Trinity. And that is why the statement is able to be made, "Let us make," and that has a plural verb, and so on and so forth. So the "us" and the "our" can be there, and it harmonizes perfectly, because the Old Testament didn't make it crystal clear about the Trinity, but it gives lots of hints. So now when we turn to the passage that Mark was asking about in Genesis chapter 6, it says in 6:1, "Now it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God." Okay. When we don't have the word "God" as a subject of a sentence, with a verb that we would either have "has said" or "have said," we have to ask, is this supposed to be translated as a singular or as a plural? I would argue this should be translated as a plural. I think it's the sons of the gods, plural. Lower G, O-D-S. Demons are quite often referred to in the Bible as gods. And so I don't think these are the sons of God, but these are the sons of the gods, that is, the sons of the demons. But our translators went into autopilot and said, oh, this is Elohim, and they decided to translate it this way here. There are some other places in the Old Testament where I don't think they translated it right. They did most of the time. Almost always they got it right, but there are a few places where I think that they didn't look closely enough at the context. So I think what it's saying here is there were the sons of the gods, that is demons, I would say demon indwelt beings, and so forth. And so there was an entrance into humanity to try to mess up God's plan. And God brings it to a conclusion. Now, the next question that Mark asked was, what about verse 3? Does verse 3 say that God is giving people 120 years of life? That's how this passage has commonly been understood. I'm going to propose a different interpretation. He's saying, 120 years from now, my spirit will stop striving with humanity and the flood will come. He's not saying people will live 120 years just anytime, whenever. He's saying judgment is not coming tomorrow. Judgment is coming in 120 years. That's when my spirit is going to stop striving with men. So, verse 3. And the Lord said, my spirit shall not strive with men forever, for he is indeed flesh. Yet his days, until the flood, that is, shall be 120 years.
Gotcha. Thank you.
So it's lots of passages have very simple explanations, but the fact that we hear them handled in certain ways makes it hard to see that there's another solution.
Thank you.
You say, 120 years from now, the flood will come.
Was it at that point that he was saying, right now I decided the flood is coming?
Yeah, I would take it here, he's saying there's going to be 120 more years before the flood comes. Meanwhile, my spirit is going to try to work with people, but after that, flood comes. Okay, let's go to Judges. Well, these are good questions. So keep reading in Genesis, have your questions. And now you notice I have question marks after Mighty Gideon. Now, just to review a couple things that we're trying to inculcate. Remember, the foreign nations that Israel needs to drive out of the land under Joshua and Judges and following can be remembered by Gakfaj. Gakfaj stands for the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. So I turned around G and H because putting an H in front of a G would be kind of odd. But when the Lord your God brings you into the land which you go to possess and has cast out many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, and the Amorites, and the Canaanites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you. Under Joshua, they had strategic victories over these nations, but there were still major pockets of resistance. And under the judges, the nation failed to drive the people out. the best that Israel ever did under the period of the judges was to play defense. But there never was an interception. They never took any land. They never took any new land. The very best that they did was to reconquer land that some new foreign invader had taken. So it's like, at their very best, they're playing defense. But most of the time, they're sitting on the sidelines. They're not in the game. Israel was in one of its worst failures, and Israel is a nation that God has demonstrated his grace to them time and time and time again, and will continue to do so despite their rebellion. Romans 9 through 11, I would title chapter 9, God's faithfulness to Israel despite its past rebellion. Chapter 10, God's faithfulness to Israel despite its present rebellion. Romans 11, God's faithfulness to Israel despite its future rebellion. God remains faithful to Israel, and we see that here in the book of Judges. They didn't earn it, they didn't deserve it, they were constantly in rebellion. The best they ever did was get off the bleachers and play defense, but they never did what God had equipped them to. They never conquered the nations and took more of the land. So we have Gakfash, the Hittites, the Girgashites, and so forth. We also have external powers. Now this, for Star Trekkies, is not Beam Me Up, but it's BMAPS. Bashan, which is up to the northeast of Sea of Galilee, the Edomites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Arameans, the Philistines, and the Sidonians. So these are basically external powers. And so Israel was expected to drive them out and not to allow the foreign invaders to come in. The book of Judges is arranged around sin cycles. The nation would get into rebellion against the land covenant. They would start worshiping foreign gods, and as a result, they would be brought into servitude. Another nation would take over land, put them into bondage. They would be under God's discipline. Then they would pray. They would supplicate to God, and God would raise up a deliverer. He would raise a judge to deliver them. And then there was a period of silence where they had rest from their enemies. But again, the very best that they ever did was to play defense. They never intercepted the ball. They never ran the ball forward. They never made any forward progress. The very best they did was to retake something that had been taken away from them. So you remember we titled this Mighty Gideon. Well, it's more like Mighty Mouse, but Gideon didn't even look as good as Mighty Mouse. So here, as we are in Judges chapter 6, we are going to see just how weak a leader has come forward. He looks as bad as Barak in the previous chapter, previous two chapters actually. But we have a problem here with the Midianites. That's one of those nations. And so, where is Midian? Glad you asked. Good question. Midian, if you see the Sinai Peninsula, and on the east side of it is the Gulf of Aqaba, and on the east side of that is Midian. Then if you look north on the map, near the Mediterranean Sea, near the Dead Sea, you'll see Amalek. Midian and Amalek and some other unspecified tribes from east of the Jordan are going to join together in order to bother Israel. And in particular, they're going to bother the northern part of the country. And so, notice we have a sin cycle beginning in 6:1a. Then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of God, in the sight of the Lord. Remember, we have sin, then there's servitude, supplication, salvation, and then silence. Here we have a very brief description. They got into rebellion. The land covenant said that although Israel has the title deed to the land forever, the only way that they can enjoy it, the only way they can be under God's blessing in the land, is for them not to be in rebellion against the land covenant. They ought to be worshiping the Lord, and they ought to be obeying Him, which means they ought to be attacking those foreign powers that are still in the land. They aren't doing that. They're trying to get along with their neighbors. They're having them pay taxes. They have them carrying wood. They have them doing servile types of things, but they are not doing what God commanded them to do. And they are in sin. They are rebelling against the land covenant. So now in verses 1b through 6, we're going to see the Midianites oppress the land with allies. So the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel. Because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made for themselves the dens, the caves, and the strongholds which are in the mountains. So it was, whenever Israel had sown, whenever they put a crop in, Midianites would come up, also Amalekites, and the people of the east would come up against them. Then they would encamp against them and destroy the produce of the land as far as Gaza, and leave no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep nor ox nor donkey. For they would come up with their livestock and their tents, coming in as numerous as locusts. Both they and their camels were without number, and they would enter the land to destroy it. So Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. So notice they cried out, that's their supplication. For 7 years this went on. Now, a couple of weeks ago, we mentioned that one of the features when liberal scholars late date the Exodus and late date the conquest by Joshua is that they see fires, all sorts of cities being burned. Cities throughout Israel. But how many cities did the book of Joshua tell us were burned with fire?
Three.
What were those three cities? Jericho, Ai, and
Hazor.
Three cities. The reason that Joshua did not burn those cities throughout the country is because God had promised that they would inhabit cities they did not build. Now, if you burn it down, or if you flood it out like Houston, how can you occupy houses you didn't build? So under Joshua, they only burnt three cities that were, they were making an example for them. God also said that they would harvest vineyards that they did not plant and so forth. However, during the time of the judges, that's when we believe that there were widespread fires. And look at what it says in verse 2. The hand of Midian prevailed against Israel. Because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made for themselves dens, caves, and strongholds which are in the mountains. That sounds like a time that they might have been burned out of their houses. Then it says, let's see, and it says that so it was whenever Israel had sown, Midianites would come up also, and the Amalekites. So they would plant a crop and it would get taken from them. Now let's take a look at, this is Aphula, that's his modern name, which is in the book of Judges known as Ophrah. By the way, Oprah Winfrey, on her birth certificate, the name Orpah was misspelled. Her mother wanted her to be named Orpah, but it got misspelled on her birth certificate. So, anyway, what we're showing here is this is Aphula or Ophrah of the Book of Judges. And you can see in the lower map on the left, that's where it is. And you can see in the upper left map, Jezreel Valley. And you remember how we were in that valley and we looked down from Mount Carmel and then we drove through it? This is the breadbasket of Israel. And this is going to be the area in particular that the book of Judges says the Midianites were coming in. They were coming into the grain belt of Israel. This, to this very day, is the breadbasket for Israel. And so they would plant their crops, and then after they planted them, you know what, Diane, I was going to switch two slides and I didn't do it. So bear with me. There are going to be a few slides here out of order. I realized when I looked at my slides as we were driving in that I needed to change it, and I got distracted and I never changed it. So Afula is going to come up a little later, and that the absent mind professor strikes again. And so we see that they would encamp against them and destroy the produce of the land as far down as Gaza. So Gaza is way down in the south along the Mediterranean Sea. It's in the vicinity of where the Gaza Strip is when you look at things today. They would leave no sustenance. So they'd slaughter all the animals, they would harvest the crops, and so forth. And so let's now look at the next section. Israel cries out, and this time, in addition to God bringing a deliverer, God sends a prophet to rebuke them of their rebellion. Verses 7 through 10. Came to pass, when the children cried out to the Lord because of the Midianites, that the Lord sent a prophet to the children of Israel, who said to them, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I brought you up from Egypt and brought you out of the house of bondage, and I delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the land of all who oppressed you, and drove them out before you and gave you their land. Also I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not fear the gods." Notice lowercase g. This is a use of Elohim that means plural. "The gods of the Amorites, in whose land you dwell, but you have not obeyed my voice. They have gone after foreign gods. They have not driven out the foreigners." They are in rebellion against the land covenant. He's saying, that's why you are under this discipline. In verses 11 and 12, we have the call of Gideon. And so, now the angel of the Lord came and sat under the terebinth tree, which was in Ophrah. So we see that here. That's Afula. This is in the southern portion of the Jezreel Valley, the breadbasket of Israel.
And that's Jesus Christ. That's
Jesus Christ. Yes. Angel of the Lord, as we talked about last week, is a reference to Jesus Christ. It's a pre-incarnate appearance of him. And this particular tree in Ophrah belonged to Joash of the Abiezrite. Now, that is one of the families within the tribe of Manasseh. This area right here, and I don't right here have a map of the tribal boundaries, but this is in the land of Manasseh, the western portion of Manasseh. And so he's mentioning a man's name, this man that is named Joash, is of this particular division of the tribe of Manasseh. But he was a pagan worshiper. We're going to see that later. His son is Gideon. And so it says, while his son Gideon threshed wheat in the winepress. Now, how did they thresh wheat? They had what was called a threshing floor. So it'd be a flat area, usually with stone, that they would have animals walk over in order to break the stalks, and that's so that you could separate the grain and that from the stalks, and the chaff would be broken up, and then they'll take things that are like shovels and toss it up in the air in the late afternoon when you have a breeze, in order that the breeze could blow away the chaff. And that's how they did their threshing. But that's not where this man is threshing his grain. Where is he threshing it? He is threshing wheat in a wine press. He's threshing on a very small scale. Now you see up in the upper right, those people's legs? Yeah, that's showing you how small this area is, because you've got a circle right in here that is where they would trample out the grapes and allow the juice to flow down into that hole. This is not a very big thing. It's telling us two things. Does Gideon have a lot of wheat? No. But the second thing is, if he goes to some place other than where the Midianites would say, oh, he's just harvested his crop, he's threshing grain, let's take it. He's doing this in a wine press in order to make it so that he's less likely to be attacked. Well, let's look here at the process of growing grain. Okay, obviously in the upper left we have a fairly recently planted field. Then in the middle picture we have wheat that's ready to harvest, and they've gone out with scythes. They're in the third picture, and now they're stacking it on wagons in order to bring it to where they can thresh it, because it used to be that you would bring the grain to a thresher, the concept of a combine that combines reaping and threshing in one operation hadn't been invented when that picture took place. Lower left, we see a threshing floor, and we see two guys in the middle picture that are getting very itchy. Nothing like having chaff get down in your clothes. And finally, we have hauling away of sacks of grain. Now let me ask you, if you were a Midianite, would you come and attack when the grain is green? Would you wait until it's ready to harvest? No, you'd rather have someone else put in the labor, get it on the wagons, get it to the threshing floor, do the threshing. You probably want to attack when they're hauling off the grain. So the Midianites would come in and they would take things right when all the labor has been put in. And that's what's being described in this section. So, we said that the Jezreel Valley is Israel's grain belt. Now, I put circles on this map, and I don't know if the red seems like it's standing out on yours. But each of those areas are places where grain is grown, either barley or wheat. And where I have the arrow pointing in the vicinity of Haifa, that's pointing towards Jezreel Valley. This is the area where Gideon is active. And this is where the crops are being stolen by the Midianites as they come in. They basically come in as raiding parties when harvest is happening. So, we have in verse 11 and 12 that the angel of the Lord has appeared to Gideon. While Gideon is threshing wheat in the wine press in order to hide it from the Midianites, angel of the Lord, and again this is pre-incarnate Lord Jesus Christ, appeared to him and said to him, "The Lord is with you, O mighty man of valor." Now that's irony. This is not a mighty man of valor. This is someone who is chicken-hearted to the core. And Gideon is going to express unbelief repeatedly in this passage. you may remember that Mark Twain said it is better to keep your mouth closed and let people think you are a fool than to open it and remove all doubt. Well, Gideon did not follow that advice. Gideon said to him, "Oh, my Lord," and you'll notice your translations have it lowercase for Lord. It is not clear. In fact, it becomes evident within this passage, he really doesn't know who he's dealing with. Some people have thought soon afterwards he offers a sacrifice. I would not think so, but we'll talk about it. "Oh, my Lord, if the Lord is with us, then why has all this happened to us? And where are all his miracles which our fathers told us about, saying, 'Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt?' But now the Lord has forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites." Does he seem to have a clue about God and his promise? Not one bit. He opened his mouth and made it quite evident that he is a fool. Well, Lord has to correct him, has to correct his theology. And when I looked at the Lord commissioning him despite his evident unbelief and weakness, it reminded me of the two paths of footprints in the sand that there was a period of time it was only one. I couldn't find that picture. But in that gap it says, "It was then that I carried you." God is going to instruct him. And so in verse 15, the Lord, or verse 14, the Lord commissions him. "Then the Lord turned to him and said, 'Go in this might of yours, and you shall save or deliver Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent you?'" It's not because of who Gideon is. It's because of who the Lord is that great things will happen. Well, Gideon opens his mouth again. And so he puts his foot in his mouth. So in verse 15, he opens his mouth again. So he said, "Oh my Lord, how can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am least in my father's house." Does this sound like a man who's confident after the Lord said, "I'm going to enable you to defeat the Midianites"? He says, great, not so much. He says, I have a very small family, and Manasseh isn't the biggest tribe, so what are we going to do? After all, they haven't had any success thus far against the Midianites or against the Canaanites that are in the land that they are supposed to possess. So, once again, the Lord reassures Gideon. Verse 16, "And the Lord said to him, 'Surely I will be with you, and you shall defeat the Midianites as one man.'" And you can imagine Gideon saying, I don't get it. Verses 17 through 18a, Gideon opens his mouth again. "And he said to him, 'If now I have found favor in your sight, then show me a sign that it is you who talk with me. Do not depart from me here, I pray, until I come to you and bring out my offering and set it before you.'" And so he's going to make an offering. This has often been seen as an offering because he recognizes the Lord is God. I don't think so. My sense here is that what we're looking at is he's saying, "You look like a pretty strong military man. I guess you're my boss. I'll give you a tribute in order to say that I'm not going to be against you. I'll be your friend." And so it would be just like paying taxes to a foreign power, something that we regularly see described in the Old Testament. But he did ask for a sign. He's saying, I'm still open to the possibility that you might be more than just a strong military man. You can do a sign and then I'll be convinced. Not so much. So the Lord said that he would wait for him until he comes back. So that once again the Lord assured him. But now we're going to have him making this tribute offering that would be appropriate to give to an ordinary human being. I do not see this as being something special because he has recognized who the Lord is. Verses 19 and 20, he makes his tribute offering. So Gideon went in and prepared a young groat and unleavened bread from an ephah of flour. The meat he put in a basket. He put the broth in a pot and he brought them out to him under the terebinth tree and presented them. The angel of God said to him, "Take the meat and the unleavened bread and lay them on the rock and pour out the broth." And he did so. He is expressing that he is a wealthy man. He has a fair amount that he's able to provide for this tribute offering. But he's still not cognizant of who he is talking with. In verse 21, though, the Lord follows through on the sign that Gideon requested. And so he touched it with his stick and it immediately lit up in flames. Verse 21, then the angel of the Lord put out the end of the staff that was in his hand, touched the meat and the unleavened bread, and the fire arose out of the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened bread. And the angel of the Lord departed out of his sight. And you can imagine that Gideon was saying, weren't you going to leave some for me and my family? Aren't there any leftovers? It just got torched. But, you know, you'd have to say that Gideon ought to be convinced that this is the Lord now. He ought to be. Not so much. He says, though, in verses 22 and 23 that he perceives it's the Lord, but he has a new problem. And his new problem is, if I really saw God, then how am I still alive? So, verses 22 and 23. Now, Gideon perceived that he was the angel of the Lord, not necessarily that he understood it was the Lord himself. He may not have understood this as a theophany yet. So Gideon said, "Alas, O Lord God," I think he's hedging his bets, "for I have seen the face of the angel of the Lord face to face." Then the Lord said to him, "Peace be with you, do not fear, you shall not die." So Gideon built an altar there to the Lord and called it, "The Lord is Peace." To this day it is still in Ophrah of the Israelites. So Gideon still is coming to terms with what's going on here. In verses 24 and 25, the Lord reassures Gideon, and Gideon then builds an altar. Verses 24 and 20, actually, yeah, 24 is where he built the altar. 25 and 26, God commanded him to tear down Baal's altar and build an altar of sacrifice and to sacrifice. Okay, let's see. I didn't go through. Here's again Aphula, which was Ophrah back in time of Judges. Aharoni uncovered this horned altar in Beersheba. Now, a horned altar has those peaks at the corners in order to be able to tie down the sacrifice. And so this is about 5 feet tall and about 8 3/4 feet square. We didn't get into Beersheba, so we did not see this. Now, I'll give you another indication here of what's coming up. We've talked about Asherah poles. The sexual connotation is not hard to see from that. The Baal worship was always accompanied by Asherah poles. And so when God is here commanding him to destroy the altar, it is the altar built by his father. Remember, Joash, that I said earlier, was a pagan. So let's look at verses 25 and 26, where God is telling him to take tear these down. Now it came to pass the same night that the Lord said to him, take your father's young bull, the second bull of 7 years old, and tear down the altar of Baal that your father has. Cut down the wooden image that is beside it, that would be the Asherah pole, and build an altar to the Lord your God on top of this rock in the proper arrangement. Take the second bull and offer a burnt sacrifice with the wood of the image that you shall cut down. In verse 27, Gideon timidly followed through. He waited until night because he was afraid to do this during the day. He's not confident that the Lord is going to deliver him as the Lord has promised. So in verse 27, he timidly tore down Baal's altar at night. Verse 27, so Gideon took 10 men from among his servants and did as the Lord had said to him. But because he feared his father's household and the men of the city too much to do it by day, he did it by night. So verse 28 through 30 is going to look at the response of the people, including his father. And when the men of the city arose early in the morning, there was the altar of Baal torn down, and the wooden image, the Asherah that was beside it, was cut down, and the second bull was being offered on the altar which had been built. So they said to one another, who has done this thing? And when they had inquired and asked, they said, Gideon the son of Joash has done this thing. Then the men of the city said to Joash, bring out your son that he may die, because he has torn down the altar of Baal and because he has cut down the wooden image that was beside it. And now Joash shows family loyalty more than loyalty to his pagan cult. In verse 31 through 33, Joash stands up for his son Gideon is renamed. But Joash said to all who stood against him, would you plead for Baal? Would you save him? Let the one who would plead for him be put to death by morning. If he is a god, let him plead for himself, because his altar has been torn down. Therefore, on that day, he called him Jerubbaal, saying, let Baal plead against him, because he has torn down his altar. He said, if the altar can be torn down, he must not really be a god. That's pretty good reasoning. Too bad that Joash hadn't figured that out beforehand. Then all the Midianites and the Amalekites and the people from the east gathered together, and they crossed over and encamped in the valley of Jezreel. And so here we have, now's the time that protection is going to be needed from the foreigners as well. So in verses 34 and 35, Gideon gathers together an army. But the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon. If that hadn't happened, Mighty Mouse wouldn't be Mighty Mouse. Then he blew the trumpet, and the Abiezrites gathered behind him. Then he sent messengers throughout all Manasseh, who were also gathered behind him. He sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, and they came up to meet them. So what we have is most of the northern tribes joined together in order to defeat the Midianites. They're willing to play defense. They've come out of the bleachers, they've gotten onto the field, they're playing defense. And so in 36 and 37, wouldn't we imagine by now that Gideon would say, okay, I get it, Lord, you're here? No, Gideon doesn't get it. Not even yet. Oh, by the way, to show where the tribes are coming from, this is perhaps a little small for print. Here's Asher, here's Zebulun, here's Naphtali, western Manasseh. So all of those tribes sent down forces in order to assist in this battle. Now we have the famous police passage. And I do not take this as a testimony of Gideon's faith. I see it as a testimony of his unbelief. He has this twice. His first fleece is in verse 36 through 38. Gideon said to God, "If you will save Israel by my hand as you've said," he should be convinced by now. "Look, I shall put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece only and is dry on all the ground, then I shall know that you will save Israel by my hand as you have said." And it was so. When he rose up early the next morning and squeezed the fleece together, he wrung the dew out of the fleece, a bowl full of water. Well, one would think that that would be enough. No, that wasn't enough. So in verses 39 and 40, he has his second fleece. "Then Gideon said to God, 'Do not be angry with me.'" Right. "But let me speak just once more. Let me test, I pray, just once more with the fleece. Let it now be dry only on the fleece, but all the ground let there be dew." And God did so that night. It was dry on the fleece only, but there was dew on all the ground. Next week we'll see Mighty Mouse with the army that he has. And we were able in Israel to visit the site where he gathered together his army. So once again, all they can do at best is play defense. Israel goes through cycles constantly of sin, servitude, supplication, salvation, and silence. We have seen how pitiful leadership was in Israel at that time. They were in constant rebellion against the Lord, and the Lord didn't wipe his hands of them. The Lord remained faithful to Israel, as he will